3. 0 Sum Gethsemane, July 10th, 2015. Back at La Posada, the signalman sits on the edge of his bed in a sweat-stained T-shirt and his Fruit of the Loom briefs, waiting on morning. It's not quite 2:30. He pours himself another shot of J&B, filling the paper Dixie cup almost precisely 1/3 of the way. He's taking it slow, pacing himself. The bottle needs to last until dawn. Right now, the thought of running out of whiskey before he runs out of night is sufficient incentive to marshal the iron fist of self-control. That might change a little later on. It's still early, after all, and the demons dancing about behind his eyes are the very competitive sort. The contents of Immaculata Sexton's fancy briefcase versus sobriety. The fear of his dreams versus exhaustion. You get the picture. The AC purrs like a cat made of ice. The curtains are pulled shut and the television's on. Clark Gable is helping Claudette Colbert make her way up the eastern seaboard from Florida to New York City. True love is on the line, or so she thinks. Albany's best man sips his J&B and stares at the screen for a while, before turning his attention back to the thick dossier the Y operative handed over at the diner. He's pacing himself with that, too. The life and times and crimes of Mr. Drew Standish. All that's known, plus some guesswork, plus just a little bit more. The signalman lights another cigarette. At 55, he remembers when it wasn't necessary to disable the smoke alarms of hotel rooms. Too often it occurs to him that he's lived just long enough to have completely outlived the world that made sense to him, the world where he fit. He's as good as a goddamn dinosaur. He picks up a sheaf of typed pages held together with a green plastic paperclip. It's obvious they were typed than it is in a printout, since almost all the O's and 8's are punched through. The page on top, a coffee-stained memorandum from Barbican Estate to its offices in Dubai, is dated October 12, 1999. Standish was a busy little beaver that year, that long string of red-letter days for doomsayers and cultists of every stripe. Never mind that the whole Y2K thing was a washout, a false alarm, a tempest in a teapot of hype. There'd be plenty of second chances for Standish, all of them leading, in hindsight, straight to that sun-blasted shack in the Coachella Valley. The signalman flips through the report, only bothering to scan every other paragraph, then drops it onto the bed with the rest. It's hard to concentrate. Faced with all this shit and alone with only his thoughts, half a pint of 70-proof scotch and old movies for company, he keeps flashing back to the ranch. That was 8 days ago now. But it hardly seems like 8 hours. Time's moving too fast for him to keep up, and even with London's prompt cooperation and the package that ghoul dressed up like a woman delivered, he feels like he's chasing his own tail. Whatever revelations and helpful relevant patterns might eventually be gleaned from the dossier, that's work for someone else, someone with distance and clarity. Someone who wasn't on the ground during the raid on Standish's compound. He takes another dry swallow of whiskey, trying to forget the sickly, musty taste of the air trapped inside that house. No such luck. Not tonight. Probably not ever. He rubs his eyes, then stares at the television screen. Clark Gable is munching a carrot and lecturing the runaway Ellen Andrews. He looks like Bugs Bunny. Sounds a little like him, for that matter. "You can't be scared and hungry at the same time," he says. "If you're scared, it scares the hunger out of you." Sure, that Peter Warne, he's one smart cookie. Before it's over, he'll get the scoop and the dame. Out on Route 66, a driver leans hard on their horn, the sound stretched and distorted by the Doppler shift. In his room, the signalman jumps, startled, immediately embarrassed, and wondering why the fuck anyone would blow their horn on an empty highway at 2:30 in the goddamn morning. but maybe there was an animal crossing the road. Maybe it was a coyote or an armadillo or good old Señor Chupacabra come round to pay its respects. He takes a drag on his cigarette and glances at the empty briefcase lying open on the bed, yawning like the jaws of a stylish, toothless carnivore. "I can't forget it. I'm still hungry," says Ellen Andrews, speaking from the celluloid ghost of 1934. And then the signalman's restless mind slips back to Friday again, that moment when he draws his revolver and steps through the doorway, crossing the threshold. And sure, he knows better, because he's already relived, replayed, revisited it all 100 times by now. But he does it anyway. The house is full of sunlight and shadows, and the smell of toadstools. He's right behind Vance. Close enough he can see the beads of perspiration standing out on her brow and upper lip, and he's wondering why she's on point. Coming up the drive, wasn't she 2 cars behind him? Crossing that maze of drooping cacti and rusted automobiles, wasn't he in the lead? There's nothing much in the front room but broken furniture, and even more dust and sand, he thinks, than there is outside. He follows Vance into the kitchen and spots a dead scorpion in the sink, belly up atop a stack of filthy dishes. Off the kitchen there's a narrow hallway, and now he can hear television static coming from one of the bedrooms. The mushroomy stink is worse back here. A lot worse. "Place is empty," says someone behind him. Malinowski, or one of the FBI mooks who haven't yet figured out they're in way over their pay grade and over their heads. "We missed him. Shitbird's probably halfway to fucking Tijuana by now." There's a calendar on the wall by the fridge, the sort you get free at Chinese restaurants. Someone circled July 3rd. He looks up to find that Vance is already in the hallway, and the signalman hesitates, starts to call her back, opens his mouth, then shuts it again. He winces at a sudden burst of white noise from the radio velcroed to his bulletproof vest. That hall, it makes him think of a slaughterhouse chute. No room to turn around in there. No room to fucking fight. "You getting the heebie-jeebies, old man? Aren't you the one who never flinched?" "Wait," he says. But his voice seems very small in the heat and the reek, small and entirely devoid of authority. "Hold up, Vance. I want to get eyes on." "Cool as shit through a polar bear. Wasn't that you?" And then he sees the look on her face, and even without seeing whatever she sees, he knows it's bad. "Oh, my God," she whispers. "Oh, God. Fuck me." The signalman picks up the remote and turns off the TV. He stubs out his cigarette and goes to the bathroom. His urine is dark, concentrated, the color of apple juice. He wonders how long until he winds up with kidney stones. His old man had them, howled in pain like a dying hound dog, and isn't that something to look forward to? He washes his hands with a tiny bar of ivory soap, then pauses to stare at himself in the mirror. The fluorescent lights make his skin seem thin as vellum, and he rubs his fingers over the salt and pepper stubble on his cheeks and chin. He should shave. He won't feel like it in the morning, hungover and late for his train. If he shaves now, it's an excuse not to go back to the dossier on Drew Standish and all the nightmares contained therein. All the warning signs nobody heeded until, as they say, it was too late. If he concentrates on shaving, maybe he can stave off the memory of what they found at the end of that hallway, and a little later, huddled on the roof. The sight of those bodies, and the smell. It's actually a number of species of fungus existing together in a symbiotic mass, Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, often referred to by a more colorful and more pronounceable moniker, zombie fungus. It attacks a particular family of tropical ants known as Camponitids, or carpenter ants, entering the host's bodies during the yeast stage of its complex reproductive cycle. The fungus spreads through an ant's body, maturing inside its head, and this is where things really get interesting. It eventually takes control of the infected insect, forcing it to latch on to the underside of a leaf and bite down in what we call the grip of death. Then atrophy sets in, quickly, completely destroying the sarcomere connections in the ant's muscle fibers and reducing its sarcoplasmic reticula and mitochondria. At this point, the ant is no longer able to control the muscles of the mandible and will remain fixed in place. The fungus finally kills the ant and continues to grow as hyphae penetrate the soft tissues and begin to structurally fortify the ant's exoskeleton. Mycelia sprout and securely anchor it to the leaf, at the same time secreting antimicrobial compounds that ward off competition from other Ophiocordyceps colonies. In the mirror, his eyes seem more gray than blue, and the broken capillaries in his nose are as good as a road map, tracing decades and countless drinking binges. But he's a prime asset, and as long as he gets the job done, Albany is happy to overlook the booze. With luck, they'll squeeze another 10 years out of him. He turns on the tap and splashes warm water across his face, then reaches for the can of shaving cream he left on the back of the toilet. And get this, okay? These doomed ants, these poor dying bastards, they always climb to a height of precisely 25.20 plus or minus 2.46 centimeters above the jungle floor, in environments where the humidity will remain stable between 94 and 95%, with temperatures between 20 and 30 Celsius, and always on the north side of the plant. In the end, sporocarps, the fungal-fruiting bodies, erupt from the ant's necking, growing a stalk that releases spores that'll infect more ants. It's evolution at its best, and yeah, at its most grisly, too. Mother Nature, when you get right down to it, she's a proper cunt. But these weren't ants. These were human beings. Well, sure, and this isn't Ophiocordyceps either. We're not even sure if it's an actual fungus. No one's ever seen anything like it. Jesus, if I didn't know better, I'd say it came from outer space. If you didn't know better. Right. The mirror is starting to fog from the steam, and there's a small bit of mercy. The signalman squirts a mound of foam into his left hand, but can't quite find the motivation to go any further. Who gives a shit if he's clean-shaven when he gets back to L.A.? Maybe he'll tell them he's decided to grow a beard. At least it would hide some of the damage wrought by time and his bad habits, wouldn't it? And isn't that what Albany's all about, hiding the damage? He rinses the foam off his hand and turns off the water. That day they all found hell by the Salton Sea. That day that's still unfurling inside his mind, Agent Vance is bracing herself against a doorframe. She's lowered her gun and covers her mouth, trying not to vomit. "Oh, God," she says again, the words muffled, and she looks at him. Right then, he thinks, "I've never seen anyone so scared." It's not true, not by a long shot, but that's what he thinks, all the same. "I know an old lady who swallowed a fly." "What?" "I don't know. It's been stuck in my head all damn day long." Past the corpses, what's left of the three girls and two boys, none of them older than 16 or 17, there's an old television set, a real antique, just like his parents bought when he was a kid. The first color TV they ever owned. There's nothing on the screen but static, a blizzard of white electric snow. It crawls across the curved screen like ants. It drifts behind the glass like deadly spores carried on the wind. "Stop the choppers," he says into the radio, even though he's not yet entirely sure why he's giving the order. Some instinct buried deep in his hindbrain, spurring him to act before higher cognition gets in the way of survival. "Get Edwards on the line and set up a no-fly zone, everything from Palm Springs south to Mexicali. Get roadblocks up." The radio crackles in spurts, and the man on the other end wants to know why. "Because I fucking just said so," he growls. "Because I imagine you want to keep your fucking job." He hears footsteps on the tin roof. Alfred Russel Wallace. He was the first to identify the fungus in Brazil way back in 1859. Yeah, Wallace. You know, the dude who almost beat Darwin to the punch. Don't you people read? In his room by the railroad tracks, the signalman dries his face on a towel embroidered with the hotel's logo. He spares one last glance at his haggard reflection, and then goes back to the bed, back to the files and the briefcase and his whiskey, back to waiting for the long Arizona night to end.